Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots.
So I'm in my kitchen and I've just gotten from work and I'm waiting on Peter to come around because we are going to record the second part of our episode, our Great Scots episode on Florence Marion McNeill. But I'm excited because I'm standing in my new kitchen, which was just finished at the weekend. And I think Peter is my first guest that I've had around to see the new kitchen, to be hosted in the new kitchen. Which feels apt that he is my sort of culinary first footer. So because we are in the early parts of this year and we're celebrating Florence Marion McNeill, I thought I'd prepare for us something from the Scots kitchen. But when we get to sort of February, March time, the one thing I start thinking about is Shrove Tuesday or Pancake Day.
All right, okay. I am about to start the Himalayan trek that is Lindsay's stairwell. She lives at the top of a Maryhill tenement. And I'm carrying several bags.
Florence has a good few pancake recipes. The one I've gone for is one that was, one, accessible, and two, felt quite similar to the pancakes that I grew up eating, and they are called drop scones or dropped scones.
Lindsay, if you're hearing this, I would like you to move to lower ground, please. I added a chap just for sound effects. Hello.
So.
Okay, right. I'm about to walk in to Lindsay's new kitchen.
My new yellow kitchen.
Dun, 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 dun,
welcome.
Dun. Wow. I mean, it's yellow.
It's very yellow.
It's a lovely yellow, though.
So it's actually two different yellows. You can't really tell in the daylight.
You can.
But the nook is a sort of slightly darker,
okay,
mustardy
now,
yellow.
Now that you've said that, I can see the vibe. Anyway, what are you? I've just seen you add a daub of butter into is that a yellow licorice?
It is.
Is it a licorice? I did once in university see Le Creuset, and my roommate laughed at me for about three years. So,
it
and
is.
every time she got the pot out, she's like, "I'm just grabbing a Le Creuset." Hi, Ailsa.
Oh.
You're a anyway.
We'll put a bleep over that.
Well.
Yes, it is my yellow creuset, which is new. It was a Christmas present from my parents because I knew that I was going to get my new yellow kitchen.
Of course.
And in it, I've put a dot of butter, and I'm going to, because we are recording our second episode of Florence Marion McNeill.
Yes.
I'm going to make us some drop scones.
Oh,
for
wow.
Her. We're also around the time of Shrove Tuesday or Pancake Day, one of my favourite.
We're within 48 hours of it.
We're within 48 hours, so it seems okay. So I thought, also because it's not too difficult a thing to make.
It's not. I, in interviewing my gran's sister up in the Highlands, she was telling me about the fact that my granny Bella, who I never got to meet, she used to keep a bowl, what would be pancakes, essentially, drop scones, Scotch pancakes. She would keep a bowl covered with a wet tea towel in the fridge at all times.
At all times, wow.
Do you have the skill of the pancakes? I mean, I'm not going to judge.
The skill of the pancakes?
Well,
sounds
I don't.
Like a myth. What do you mean?
I don't have, like, they're never an even color.
Okay.
They are often sort of leoparded.
Leopard, yeah.
There's often leoparding on the bottom where you get sort of inconsistencies. Like halfway through, I'll try to flip one. The knife will get dragged through it and it'll be uneaten. Like, it's just, it's a
task. Skill. I mean, so it was quite common when I grew up that every Sunday, one of us would make pancakes.
Right, okay.
And
This is so idyllic.
Adding to my annoying middle class background, we had Naga.
A rook.
So, so you wouldn't even cook them on the in a pan. Yeah. You would just cook them straight on the griddle.
Are you like directly related to Enid Blyton, or is it like a is it like a second cousin type thing?
No.
No.
Unfortunately. Right, there's too much butter in this pan.
Really. I wasn't going to say anything.
There is.
Too it's much not butter. My place.
There is too much butter in this pan. So the first, I always think, oh no. Oh no.
See, this is what happens to me. Right, this is. I feel so much better about myself right now.
I was like, I know how to make pancakes.
I'm quite good at making pancakes.
Love the impression. Okay, that one's better.
But that's my like generic middle class impersonation.
The first pancake is always going to be right? And then you get used to it.
Perhaps. I mean, so I will say like my mum is like queen of drop scones, queen of Scotch pancakes, or as we call them here, pancakes.
Just pancakes.
Lindsay, that is.
I swear to God, I made loads of these the other day and they were all lovely.
I'm sure. I'm sure they were absolutely delicious. But
mop up
she has her pancake spoon.
Okay.
Which is just a large, like, antique tablespoon.
Yeah.
She has her pancake knife, mm-hmm. which is just a bit like a kind of...
Like a... Oh, what do you call it?
Like a palette knife?
Yes, but it's exactly.
But it's smaller. Exactly. It's like, not a proper palette knife. It's like a butter knife without a serrated edge or anything. And every single pancake is the same... Even color, mm-hmm. the same size.
Yeah.
It's like a perfect, like, slightly well done tablet.
Yes.
Color.
That, and like, even across the whole board.
Even across, yeah. Like,
we have, this is the good pancake of these two, and they're still mottling.
But it's just repetition.
Yeah.
And I just don't make pancakes enough. You have no excuse.
I used to make pancakes enough, and alas.
Maybe you're just out of practice.
The issue there was too much butter, so.
No, I'm not going to give you critical feedback because these smell delicious and they will taste delicious.
They are not my finest work.
I'm not judging.
Initially, there was far too much butter in the pan. I will take that. That is a criticism. That was all on me.
Also, so this is exactly what I would create. However, I did admit to being terrible at making drop scones.
I don't think
they're not terrible. They're going to be delicious. I enjoy them. We don't need perfection.
I think the pan was too small too. I wanted to use my new pan.
Because it's yellow.
And because it's yellow, but like actually you want a larger flat space. You really need a griddle. But they were from our beloved Florence Mary McNeil's.
From the Scots Kitchen.
Yep. One of her many pancake or drop scone recipes. I was tempted to make deer horns.
What?
Which involve flour, sugar, almonds, lemon, egg, and cream. And then you have to deep fat fry them. So it's basically a donut.
I was doing a bit of research about the history of the yum yum.
I love a yum yum.
But...
Are they a West Coast thing? Are they a Central Belt thing?
They are, well...
Because they are a Northeast thing as well.
Well, they are a Northeast thing.
Ha ha.
I have been looking at... The history of yum yum, which really only begins to appear in like the 80s in bakery advertisements.
Yeah.
And was trying to work out where they came from. And I was looking at the Scots Kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and it had a recipe for an Aberdeen cruller.
Yeah, there you go.
And it's an Aberdeen, because it's a type of bannock.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, an Aberdeen cruller, which then migrated to America,
mm-hmm.
and became which the cruller.
The cruller, yeah, that's...
The cruller, so sorry. The cruller.
Cruller, whatever they call it. But yeah, that's so funny.
But let's tuck into some pancakes. I'm so excited. And I'm a labouer only. Yeah. I'm a purist here.
So you have some butter there. Florence has suggestions for how you will enjoy your drop scone. She says... Serve warm or cold, but fresh.
Okay.
And ours are somewhere in between that now. With butter or honey or jam. And then she says, children like them buttered hot and then topped with fine brown sugar. Which sounds quite nice.
Feels very decadent.
Yeah.
For When did you write this? 1929?
Yeah. I feel like if you're doing butter and then brown sugar, you may as well brulee it and then it becomes
Yeah.
some kind of like fancy West End snack.
Can't wait till you're a mum, Lindsay. You might as well brulee it if we're adding sugar to your pancakes. It's a Saturday morning. What are we going to do after all?
Have you heard of bruleed Weetabix?
Have you used that pan before?
I think I have, but it never made it in.
Okay.
Should we do it again?
No, there might be a slight onion or garlic.
Oh, no. In the pan. Maybe it's probably the butter.
Is it the butter?
Yeah.
It's not bad at all. They're not overly sweet. I'm here for a buttery garlicky drop scone.
It's probably the butter. I've used the pan before, but not...
Not for our allium.
No. Apologies.
There is definitely...
There's definitely...
Do you know what it might be? Your fish slice.
Potentially. Yeah.
I'm, like, really craving, like, a smoked salmon on top of this now.
It should be a bellini.
No, I'm, like oh, yeah. a little bit of a salmon roe.
No, you're right. It's either the butter... I think it's either the butter or the knife. Like, this was sweet until I put the butter on top. I'm so sorry.
No, there was definitely, I was like, is my flavor. I went with my, it's delicious, Lindsay. Thank you very much.
It's still nice.
We get to have a second conversation about Florence.
Lucky us.
Lucky us. Because there was just too much for us to be able to squeeze it all into one episode. I would say our strength is not self-editing when we're talking about Florence Marion McNeil.
I mean, I don't think we could possibly do that if we wanted to. There's too much gushing that goes on.
Exactly. But where did we get to last time?
I think we basically got up until the point where we wanted to focus on her books specifically. Mm. Oh, Sue!
So yeah, we got up to 1929, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Or the release of her... book Iona.
Yes.
And then obviously The Scots Kitchen. And what we see when she releases The Scots Kitchen is reprinted, I think, three times in the first year.
Yep.
And
that's good going.
Is an kind of an instant success. Partially because of its kind of very strong like reliance on celebrating bygone food.
Mm-hmm.
And despite it being we're not Victorian anymore, we're right into the 20th century.
Yep.
People are separated from kind of historic living.
Mm-hmm.
Their great grandparents may have been crofters, but they've been living in urban cities, slightly disconnected from Scottish identity, perhaps with kind of dribs and drabs of Hogmanay first footing and Halloween guising, but have lost lots of that Scottish food.
And there's a real nostalgia piece there. It's like, what does it mean to be Scottish? Things are shifting, you know, increasing mechanization, increasing, like, identity around everything. It's a strange point in time where it's like, is being Scottish different anymore?
Hmm.
So, yeah, she's hitting a key moment.
Yeah. And The Scots Kitchen does so well that she then goes on to print another bunch of books. She then goes on to write an entire catalogue of Scottish food and Scottish folklore.
Yes.
My favourite is the Book of Breakfasts.
I mean, how can you go wrong with the Book of Breakfasts?
But in it, it details, again, just like the wealth of food that people have eaten for their petit déjeuner in the morning. There are umpteen egg recipes. There's a really great kind of opening to the book where it talks about breakfasts and then gives examples of menus over the last 200-300 years about what people were eating in a croft house, what people were eating in a manse, what people were eating in the Highlands or in a great house like Abbotsford.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things that reintroduced me to yet another aspect of our food.
Scottish people are really good at breakfast. I think that's one thing we do really well. And obviously we will touch upon that in one of our episodes to follow, but we do breakfast really well. We're, you know, no one needs to hear about how much you love a morning roll, Peter, but It all.
Sorry.
I mean, sorry.
It
Everyone
needs
needs to
to
hear.
hear.
I mean, what I mean is, everyone should have heard about how much you love a morning roll. But yeah, I think breakfast is one of those things that we just, as a nation, have kind of championed.
Yeah. And the other books that she does is a series called The Silver Bough, which
Yeah.
is a focused on the calendar of the
The
year, the
folklore,
folklore,
yeah.
our relationship with the witches, our relationship with holidays and feasts. My favorite one is Halloween to Yule because it's just so rich. There's
Yeah.
so much. And again, if you listen to our last season,
Yeah.
all we talked about was these books. And it's our only insight into folklore. And this is what's really special, because again, we're going to keep saying this is what's really special about Florence. But she wasn't concerned with the grandiose. She was not concerned
No.
with the modern. She was concerned with the preservation of Scottish identity.
Yeah.
And so now we have these texts in it and can kind of give us some insight into what our grandparents, our great grandparents, our great 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 grandparents, our ancient people. It gives hints towards things like gods and bogies and monsters and
Yeah.
fairies. Oh my, you know, there's
Yeah.
so much in there. It's such a rich. Well, I feel like you say text a lot, and I'm going to try and do that more because it feels very PhD. It's a very rich text.
Is, and she has a whole catalogue of rich texts that really, as we will go on when we speak to our guest this episode, like uncover, she kind of establishes a canon for not just Scottish food writing, but Scottish identity.
Well, I can't join you for this. You see, this is a bit where we're going
Yeah.
to ruin the magic, which is that
Yeah.
you had the Zoom interview a couple of days
Yeah.
ago, and I couldn't make it because I was working,
Yeah.
and therefore you said we
The
could
fourth
have,
wall is broken.
we could have like edited it so it was like I was just like sitting and like adding a question every
I
now
should
and
get a
then.
Peter cutout.
No one's going to believe that I wouldn't interrupt a conversation for 20 minutes. My favorite thing about this is the first 3 minutes.
I'll do a more formal pod. So trying to get into like Peter's really good at getting into like podcast mode, and he quite quickly snaps into presenteriness. So I will try and embody him just now. So I'm delighted to be joined. Oh. Thank you for that.
Your Peter impression is absolutely fantastic. But let's have a wee listen to your conversation with Gina Lyle.
So while we think about the legacy of Florence Mary McNeill, you know, a woman who, as we've discussed, has done so much, so many different things for Scottish culture and Scottish writing and Scottish food, we thought it would be wonderful to sort of round out that image of her contribution to Scottish culture. And we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Gina Lyle, who is, I mean, Gina, you can correct me on this, but I would say a sort of literary critic, expert on Scottish literature, and in particular, you've looked at thing writing about meat, haven't you?
Yes, I found out about Florence through a project looking at meat in contemporary Scottish fiction. I was hoping to learn a bit more about the history of how that sort of operated in the nation, and who better to turn to than Florence Mary McNeill in A Scots Kitchen.
So was it A Scots Kitchen that was the first book you
Oh,
looked at?
100%. It's the first thing you come up if you search, I think, Scottish food, full stop.
Yeah.
That is the Bible as far as the sort of field of study is concerned. And reading that, I was absolutely just struck by what a wonderful communicator she was. Led me on to finding about things like the Silver Bough and her work in folklore as well as in food, and eventually finding out about her political history and her novel as well. She's done it all.
She has done it all, and I think that's one of the most fascinating things about her, the fact that, you know, The Scots Kitchen is obviously a wonderful, I mean, I suppose you could call it a cookbook, but it's actually more like an ethnography, and the way that she's clearly gone around and gathered all of these recipes and also attributed them to other sources. It's like she's doing the work of an ethnographer or an oral historian. But then to then also go into creative writing is really interesting.
Yeah, it's not dissimilar from like the ballad collecting that we see a lot of Scottish literature. It's folklore collecting, it's folk tradition collecting. And I think The connection between Florence Nightingale and the literary context is really interesting. If you open up The Scots Kitchen, it begins with a reference to Walter Scott's St. Ronan's Well and Men of Gods. And the cookbook that came out of that project and everything, it finishes with a quotation from Robert Burns. And in between, you have references to, I don't know, Alan Ramsay, to Robert Ferguson, to William Dunbar, to Susan Ferrier. You can't get away from literary representations. So she's incredibly well read. References for everything. And so I don't know if I was necessarily surprised to find that she herself had produced, she had written creatively.
I've not read The Road Home. It sounds quite, I'm guessing it's quite autobiographical.
You are absolutely correct. You're not the only person who hasn't read this. It's currently out of print, and as far as I can tell, it's only had the one publication in 1932.
Oh, wow, gosh.
There is a copy in the National Library in Edinburgh, which I encourage, if you have the time and inclination, you have access to that. But you're exactly right, it's so autobiographical. It's a novel that begins around the time that Florence herself would have been a child in Orkney, in a family where the father is a reverend,
Yep,
like
so it's all
one.
lining up.
It's incredibly autobiographical. So there's a lot in there that really does map on to her personal history. There are lots of changes, there's lots of different approaches, but so much about it mean that our main character, Morag, really does feel like a way of accessing Florence's history. So if you're interested in her at all as a person, this book is such a revelation in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And when, do you know when in her life she published it?
So was she born 85? So this would have been her approaching her 50s.
Right, so it's quite a late in life project. So I like that kind of reflective, you know, it's the road home, but also the road that she's been on and it's got her to where she is now.
I think it's a really strong title because it's divided into four sections and an epilogue. The first section reads incredibly like any classic children's literature. It's episodic adventures in Orkney. The children are stealing flowers from the neighbors' gardens and getting in trouble for it, or meeting a friend's cousin, sorry, for the first time. That kind of juvenile excitement. But the tone gets increasingly miserable, increasingly dark as Morag grows up. I cried in the library, I'll be honest. As we see Morag lose a connection with her family in Orkney, move to Glasgow for university, move to London for work, and then in the epilogue, return to the Highlands and Islands to visit family, to have that connection with home again.
One of the things we've been discussing is how tragic parts of her life were when she, you know, tended to lose siblings and parents kind of all in one fell swoop or two fell swoops throughout her life, but still managed to accomplish so much. So, yeah, that sense of grief coming through her writing, I would imagine would be quite palpable.
Yeah, it's, I think, tonally very clear. I think if I had to put my finger on it, I'd say so much of the sort of loss of it is slightly languagey. Her character Morag doesn't speak Gaelic, but when she returns to her family's islands, she goes, "Here is my language. This is it belongs to her." So there's something about communication that comes up again and again. There's always difficulties with expressing herself. At one point, she writes a curt little letter to a love interest, hoping to keep him on his toes. All it does is turn him off completely. He is furious with her.
Oh
So there's
no.
all these problems with being able to articulate the grief, the emotion, the feeling, and it comes up a few times for her. So it's really beautifully done, really articulately talking about how difficult it is to be articulate.
And I think that, again, obviously don't want to read too much into the work of a woman who can't speak for herself anymore, but I think so much of the whole body of Florence's work seems to be preoccupied with the idea of what could be lost if this stuff isn't recorded. Even The Scots Kitchen, you know, she's collecting these recipes, she's recording them, she's giving them a kind of cultural weight by putting them in this text that ensures that they are now being consulted by you, by me, by people who love Scottish food. And I wonder whether that was a preoccupation of hers, particularly coming from a place like Orkney, where which is so There's so many traditions. It's such a sort of, I don't know, you're out in this incredibly remote place living this life. I can only imagine how, wild it must feel sometimes, but also, I don't know, yeah, that journey from like Orkney, Glasgow, London, it must have been quite jarring to think about life in different spots and how things might be lost if they weren't recorded.
Yeah, I think I was surprised almost by how little discussion of food and folk tradition there was in the novel. There are obviously references. There's a really great point where Morag goes to a friend's house and is aghast to see that they thum the butter into scones. They're not buttering a scone with a knife, they are pressing it in with the thumb.
Oh, interesting.
That is exactly her response. And there's a superstition of your first footing on New Year's Day, the idea that you want a tall, dark man to be the first guest in your home for good luck for the year. Guess what Morag's family get? They get a blonde girl.
Oh, bad
And it's
tidings.
a terrible omen for the year. But it honors that. It comes true. It's a bad omen for the way the year
Gosh.
plays out. So there are gestures, references to those interests in food and folk tradition. One of the things I think that really struck me about the text was how engaged it was with women's opportunities and in particular women's education. Early in the children's childhood section of the book, we learned that Morag's mother was smart enough to go to university, but it was not open to women at that time. A rector at the university, a rector at her school says it's a shame they can't put breeks on her and send her over. When Morag grows up and that's an opportunity for her, it's brilliant, but limited in certain ways. She's invited to debates, but only the men are allowed to speak. There's a general rumor going around that no woman can earn a first-class degree just on a matter of principle. And so there's small barriers, lots of conversation about marriageability and attractiveness in the girls because it's a bit of a meat market. Morag doesn't feel a part of that. She doesn't feel comfortable with it.
And I think what's fascinating about her and her family was how much they put into education. So, so many children, I believe all of them were university educated, or at least could be if they'd wanted to be. And her activism early on in her life around things like women's rights and suffrage and even things like women's sexual health was so kind of ahead of its time that I'm not surprised that that comes through in the novel at all. And I think that's one of the reasons why, I mean, obviously I'm coming at it from like a food history angle, and I feel like she should be more well known from that perspective for what she's done for Scottish food history. But actually what she's done for wider parts of Scottish society, or was doing, back in the sort of early 20th century, was incredible. And how do, like, I mean, what do you think the loss would be if she hadn't If Florence hadn't been.
Well, I don't think it bears thinking about.
No.
No, I think the huge amount of work for women's rights and for Scotland's political representation is just, it cannot be neglected. And she presents such an interesting figure in that so many of these interests that we know are connected are so overt, so obviously linked in her work, where culture and politics are hand in hand. I think that's what makes her so special is there's no neglect of one to prioritize the other. She's able to do it all
I
in
know.
a way that's beyond admirable. Madness, really, to think about accomplishing that much.
I know you kind of wonder what her day-to-day life looked like. Like, I would love to be a fly on the wall for like a week in the life of Florence Mary McNeill. She must have just never stopped. But yeah. I mean, I'm intrigued to return to the topic of food. When you were using her initially as that kind of source material, was there anything in particular that struck you about either the way she was using meat? Like, what were the kind of conclusions that you drew from the Scots Kitchen for your own research?
The phenomenal wealth of research that she had done meant that I had reference points for practices not just in one part of the country, but in many. You can see regional distinctions that I think very often Scotland is flattened into a monolithic Scotland. And that's not necessarily the experience, not in terms of language, not in terms of food. So having someone who is articulating how regional specialties and things develop was so phenomenally helpful. Even just her section about like the history of oysters in Edinburgh opened up like a whole new fascinating little field of study to go, oh my gosh, did you know how many oysters people were eating back then? Oh my
I
God.
know. And then you go to Edinburgh and you see like them in the walls, like oyster shells
The
in the walls
evidence,
of these
yeah.
old buildings, which is just mind-boggling now to think, oh, we're eating so many oysters, let's just build houses out of them.
Yeah, unfathomable to us now because the culture shifts so much. And I think that's
Exactly.
one of the things it really does well is it captures how things have started moving. So even though we're now a few years away from the publication of Scott's Kitchen, so much of it highlights already how practices are evolving and shifting and what's altered already. And it lets you kind of see the trajectory of things. If our food systems are becoming globalized, are there any regional specialties that remain popular and celebrated? Do we still eat up one side and down the tether of an animal, or are we a bit more selective about the cuts we buy now? It was really, really enjoyable. I think because her writing style is so personable and full of character and flavor and reference, comes across as very insightful and educated and very friendly. I think she makes herself super available to new readers, so do not be afraid of picking up any of her works. She will be a friend to you.
A friend to you. I love that. Yeah. And I think quite important for a woman who was doing so much, especially when she was doing quite a lot, like quite a lot of her political activity could have potentially been polarizing and may have put people off. So to be able to get that balance where she's still approachable, you know, reading The Scots Kitchen, you kind of you do, it's almost that like she's comparable, I think, to like Elizabeth David or Julia Child for like the personality coming out of the text and being quite warm and comforting. So yeah, the fact that she's not more celebrated in or more well known even, I think, unless you're working in food, a lot of people just don't know who she was, which is what we're trying to change. Okay, right, let's finish then on some quick fire questions about Scottish food for you, Gina.
Oh gosh.
Your morning roll order, what type of roll are you having and what filling?
I would like a morning roll, please. And I would like square sausage and a tatty scone.
Classic. And what
Perfectly
filling?
designed, they're not going to roll out.
I
Brown
know.
sauce, if I may.
Yes. Sorry, was that brown sauce or red?
Brown sauce, I'm
Correct
sorry.
answer. Not that we're not judging, but good answer. For your bread, plain or pan?
I'm sorry. Plain.
I think plain's the right answer. I love
Had
plain.
a lot of pan bread in my day, and I'm done with it now.
How do you have your porridge?
I have it sweet. I do
Okay.
brown sugar or maple syrup, and I do fruit.
Fruit. Nice. What kind of fruit?
Oh, today, pear.
Oh, yum.
Yesterday, blueberries.
Blueberries is a classic. I do love the sort of blueberry brown sugar cream combo
Hard
always.
to go wrong.
If you're having a tonics, would you have a log, a wafer, or a tea cake?
I would have a tea cake and I would hit it against my head, pick off chocolate that shattered, and then eat it in the most disgusting manner.
My mum used to have a cat that apparently could unwrap a tea cake, eat all the chocolate and the marshmallow, and just leave the foil and the biscuit base.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Bonus points for flattening out the foil over your knee.
I love it. They're so satisfying. They're so beautiful. Okay, if you were going to put a family recipe into a cookbook or a Scottish cookbook, what would your family recipe be?
Oh, I think it has to be my gran's beef curry.
Oh, yum.
There's something about the way that woman practically boils fruit. She boils dried fruit into the sauce base. I've
Wow.
never had anything like it. You have to trust me that it works.
Yeah.
Because I asked her as an adult, I was like, "Gran, how do you accomplish this?" And she described to me a process that is so unusual. That it can only be from a time before Indian curry houses were common in the country.
Yeah.
It absolutely divine.
Wow, that sounds interesting, but absolutely delicious. Okay, what ingredient in your kitchen do you have that you turn to the most?
I don't know.
Like
No.
store cupboard thing, what do you always have in? What is your sort of
I always have a red lentil. You can always make an emergency soup, an emergency dal. You can pull it together into a few things. I have a recipe for my own haggis, a veggie haggis you can
Ooh,
make, and they're
delicious.
surprisingly helpful to have. They'll never
That's
go off.
never not have a lentil in. Okay, what is your favorite Scottish word?
Oh, I'm overwhelmed. The one I always introduce visitors to is shugle.
Shuggle, that's a good one.
Enjoy a shugle.
And can you spell that for our listeners? Because I think the spelling's important.
I would spell it Shougle. I
That's
would give
exactly how I would
it a
spell it
good
as well.
shugle.
Shuggle, yeah. Because you can shuggle or you can shuggle something. It's very adaptable.
If you're on the underground in Glasgow, you are getting shugled about.
You are. Especially with the new ones, which are more shuggly than the old ones. It's, yeah.
Shuggle, a gentle wobbling. If you are on thin ice, you are on a shuggly peg.
A
You are
shuggly peg.
hanging
Oh,
on a
that's so good.
dangerous.
I'm going to
Yeah.
start saying that to people when they annoy me. You're on a shuggly
Well, I highly recommend it. It's a really
peg.
fun one.
And then, can you remember the first job that you were given either to help with or to do on your own in the kitchen?
I'm trying to think now. I'm notoriously was a terrible child who no one
Oh,
wanted
I
involved.
can't imagine that.
No, I think it must have been the very classic peeling potatoes. I don't think there was anything more involved, and I think I was told off for wasting too much of the
You were
potato.
just too enthusiastic
Just
carving away the.
hacking out huge cuts because obviously you were given a knife and not a peeler. And I do not have the hand-eye coordination for that even now. So peeling potatoes, there we
Peeling
are.
potatoes. Good. Love that. Love that. Oh, well, thank you so much, Gina. It's been so nice to chat to you about all things Florence and her novel. And I think we've resoundingly made a case for it being not just reprinted, but celebrated and put on syllabuses in Scotland, syllabi in Scotland, everywhere.
Yeah, enter into the canon now, Florence.
Yes,
Make the
yeah.
old step forward.
Absolutely. It is her time. Oh, there's so many books we need reprinted. I mean, there's a Scott's Kitchen, a new printing coming out soon, which is great, but I want the breakfast book, I want Camper Kitchen, want them all.
Oh, and the cover to her Halloween selection is phenomenal as well.
Yes, so
Yes.
good.
Oh,
Oh, well, thank you, Gina. This has been a joy.
thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
No, that was a great conversation. I have to say, the ergonomic principle of her breakfast roll order will stay with me forever. N nothing can roll out. It has never occurred to me before.
But surely that's why a square sausage is square.
I believe a well, do you want to dive into a conversation about Lawrence
I
Sausage?
mean, maybe now is
N
not
maybe now
the
is not the time. Well, that will be season 3.
Why is a
Scottish
square
Breakfasts,
sausage square?
episode 3, The Ergonomic Principles of Lawrence Sausage. But yeah, I think what I found really interesting is your conversation about what would life have been like if Florence wasn't here.
Yeah. I mean, as we speak about, not just unthinkable in terms of our lack of knowledge around food history, but just everything, like women's rights, politics. She was influencing everything.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of your political affiliations, the party that she founded with her brother Duncan is currently our government. And the fact that we have had so many women leaders as part of that government, the fact that working class and rural communities have been a fixture of that government, I think is certainly in a large part thanks to the foundations that she laid as a founding member and the first vice president of the Scottish Nationalist Party.
Yeah, I mean you can't undercut that influence and the
No.
importance of that to Scotland as a nation. And again, regardless of your affiliations, it's just the fact that she was seeding this when she was is incredible.
Yeah.
And I think speaks to what a powerhouse she was as a woman. Not just a woman, but like a woman in Scotland at that time doing all these things on multiple lengths. Like through multiple lenses, it's quite incredible. Like, I would be so impressed by her if she had just done what she'd done for Scottish food. But what she's done for Scottish culture and Scottish women since and Scottish education.
And I'd be
And
impressed if she was doing it today.
yeah,
She
exactly.
was doing this in when she started 19, 1911. She
I
came back to
know.
Glasgow. Since 1911, she has been campaigning for women's rights, for Scottish politics, for the recognition of the working classes, for the protection of minors, for the celebration of Scottish food, for the proliferation of education on Scottish culture. There is so much that she has done in her lifetime. I think because she was not a human being who was at the forefront, she quietly got on with the work, and the work has led to a life of a legacy that we are still enjoying today.
Still enjoying, but not championing.
No.
And that is why we are here now.
I have a little surprise for you.
Oh.
You've never heard Florence's voice before, have you?
No, I haven't.
Are you ready?
I don't know if I am. I feel like hearing her voice is gonna like make her three-dimensional in a way I'm not prepared for.
Yeah.
Wow.
Let us listen to the woman herself, Florence Marion McNeil.
Miss F. Marion McNeil talks about her Orkney childhood.
We went to the parish school, and I used to learn from the children there all sorts of stories. I used to hear about witches and fairies and mermaids and whatnot, and I lapped it all up. I used to be terrified of any strange old woman I met in case she was a witch.
The landscape itself, did that make a great impression on you as a child?
Oh, indeed it did. I think that great arch of sky was most impressive. And then the atmosphere, especially I remember those wonderful sunsets. I used to think I was looking at the gates of heaven when the western sky was all crimson and gold.
Then the people, how did the manse children see them?
Oh, well, they meant a great deal to us. We used to go in and out among the cottages. We were always made welcome. There's so much hospitality. And we used to love the island fare, the bear bannocks and the Orkney cheese, and especially a cake called Bruni that I was very partial to, a kind of oatmeal gingerbread.
How did you get introduced to that?
Well, we used to take pieces to school, and I used to have perhaps Carvey biscuits or something. The other children thought rather exotic. And I remember one little girl used to bring along a kind of oatmeal gingerbread, which she called Bruni. And we used to barter, exchange our pieces at times. And I was so intrigued with this that I said to her one day, "What's in it?" I was about perhaps 5 or 6 at the time, so I collected my very first recipe.
Oh, yes. And that was the genesis of the Scots kitchen, perhaps?
It was. It was, in a sense. It was my very first recipe.
Well, in one delightful essay of yours I've read, you mention a lady called Beanie, who used to serve at the manse. Have you any memories of her?
Oh, indeed I have. That wasn't her real name, but I'll still call her Beanie. Yes, she was a very wise old woman, and she had a friend who was what I consider a white witch, who knew all sorts of old lore. I wish I had known as much as I do now. I could have collected so much that I'm afraid it's gone forever.
Do you have any practical instances of that?
Oh, yes, we had a rather amusing experience one summer. We had a house full of visitors, and Beanie was about to churn in the kitchen when an old woman, a reputed witch, passed by, looked in through the window, and the butter just didn't come that day. Beanie came through in a great state, and she said, "You know, the butter's been bewitched. It won't come. The churn's been bewitched." And we laughed, and however, next week she churned again, and the third week, and there wasn't a sign of butter. So Beanie went off to consult an old woman who's a reputed, well, a white witch, if you like. She was supposed to know all sorts of secrets that most people didn't know. And she came back in triumph. She'd got a counter charm. So the next turning day, we all went through, including we had a young English woman who was a BSc and was terribly amused at all this. And we all collected around the churn, and Beanie began to churn, and in no time the butter came thick and fast. And then she disclosed the secret. She'd been told to put a piece of silver in the churn.
I see, these were terrible goings on at the manse. Did the minister know about that?
Oh, I think my father was a little bit of a pagan beneath his Presbyterian veneer.
Quite.
He enjoyed it.
Yes, and in those days there were all kinds of strange beings around. There were mermaids even, weren't there?
Oh, we had the Dearness Mermaid. That was a great thing in our childhood. We used to take our summer visitors over on the chance of seeing the mermaid, which appeared only when the wind was in the north. And only in summer weather.
Did you ever see the mermaid, Miss McNeil?
I didn't, but many people I know did. They saw, well, scientists used to come up to try and discover what it was. Some people think it was a peculiar kind of seal, but extraordinarily like a human being at long distance.
That's made me quite emotional.
I mean, I think the fact that in that very small clip, she talks about her first recipe and inspiring the Scots kitchen, her dad's pagan beliefs.
I love that. The fact that, like, oh, how were the children at the manse doing?
Yeah.
Well, we were all pagans.
We were all pagan. We were trying to create a counter charm for some bewitched butter. There's a children's story in here somewhere.
Yeah.
A fascinating woman. And this year, we have put our heads together to start the first annual commemoration and celebration for Florence Marion McNeil. Now, it's going to be on the 26th of March, and we're calling it World Bannock Day.
World Bannock Day, that speaks to our ambitions.
Yes.
World Bannock Day.
Because there's lots of people around the world who are Scottish.
Yeah, the diaspora is wonderful and widespread.
And every single person who is Scottish, or a feminist, or a suffragist, or a politically engaged human being fighting for what they believe is right, can claim Florence Marion McNeil as their own and bake a bannock.
And bannocks are so delicious and so easy.
Yes.
So,
what are you going to have on your bannock?
Oh, see, when you made us bear meal bannocks last time, they were so good.
I made them again, and I think
they're incredible. They're delicious. I mean, just like a slick of butter was incredible, but that Orkney cheese.
Orkney cheese. Oh. Well, see, when she mentioned in that
she
clip,
mentioned that, I know.
Having bear bannocks and Orkney cheese,
I felt like something spiritual, like, was complete in me that I've eaten that. So that's what I will be going for on the World Bannock.
A bear bannock from, and again, for those of you who wish to engage with a bear bannock, you can get it from Barony Mill in Orkney. They do deliver.
Yeah.
And Orkney cheese, you should get it any local. You can get it in places like Morrison's. If not, find a local deli or cheesemonger. They will definitely have an Orkney cheese. I think we should raise a glass.
I'm with you.
To one fine, fine woman.
A great, in fact, maybe the greatest of Scots.
To Florence Marion McNeil.
To Florence Marion McNeil.
This episode of the Scottish Food History Podcast was presented by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. Many thanks to Dr. Gina Lyle for appearing in this episode. This episode was also produced by Tenement Kitchen. If you want to find out more about World Bannock Day, please come and visit my Instagram at Tenement Kitchen.